Okay, it's all right. Sorry, you guys.
All right, thank you. I'm Mark Eccles, chairperson of the Utah Geological Survey Board. I'd like to call this meeting of the Utah Geological Survey Board to order. The time is now 8:31 on January 9th, 2018. This meeting is being held in conference room 3110 of the Natural Resources Building in Salt Lake City, Utah. In compliance with Utah's open meeting laws, this meeting will be recorded in its entirety. The recording is classified as a public record. The following board members are in attendance: Mark Eccles, Dave Garbutt, Rick Chestnut, Ken Fleck, Sam Quigley, Alyssa Richards, and Tom Faddies. The following board members are absent. That's Pete Kilborn. The following individuals representing the Utah Geological Survey and the Department of Natural Resources are in attendance: Rick Allis, Division Director, Mike Hilland, Deputy Director, Jody Patterson, Financial Manager, and Pam Perry, Board Secretary.
And Steve Bowman.
Did he put anything else?
Well, I'm going to write the stuff there, so that, well, in this Pam's second one.
Oh, well, I write it on there. You see it.
Like we have anybody here from the public. As a courtesy to everyone participating in this meeting, at this time we ask for all cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices to be turned off or changed into silent mode. Board motions. Speaking of which. Board motions and votes must be reflected in the minutes and recorded by individual board member. Let us now proceed with the agenda. First thing on the agenda, I'd like to welcome everybody to the meeting. Happy New Year. Hope everybody had a good holiday. I'm sure we're all praying for snow every night. First item on the agenda is the approval of meetings from the August 17th, 2017 board meeting. Those were included in your packet.
I have one item. I was not here.
Oh,
okay. Excuse me as being here. I was not.
Okay, so we're going to cross Ken off.
Okay. You move Ken.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Are there any other additions or deletions or comments about these minutes that we need to worry about? Somebody like to move to approve the minutes? Second?
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor? All those opposed? Okay, minutes are approved unanimously. Next item is the director's report. So, Rick, I'll turn the time over to you.
Yeah, so in reading the minutes that we just talking about, actually last night, if I look you, I realized there was a recommendation or a direction from the board to have as an action item at the following meeting all those proposals that we send out by email for approval to proceed, which may or may not, because everyone's looking at the Open Meetings Act and what controls this, whether that constitutes official approval or not is sort of questionable. So just to get over that, we present a list of what happened since the last meeting that you approved, just so there's a minuted item saying, yes, they were approved and we've proceeded on them. So that's an extra action item. Pam pulled out this morning the list of the various proposal to propose forms, so at some point, in fact, we could do it now, just get out of the way. The list, if you like, I'll just read out to remind you what went through. You did approve electronically everything. So there was a proposal to excavate Dolwings Bowl. That was to the BLM that everyone approved. There was a Castle Valley water monitoring. We'll actually talk in my report, we'll quickly look at where things are at. So there was Castle Valley water monitoring proposal, there was an Emigration Creek septic discharge study, there was Pinyon Juniper treatments, Box Elder and Hugh's going to be talking about that project, and the sources of funding for that, mixed sources. There was a water budget for Juab Valley, division of water rights. There was an aquifer storage and recovery project for Richmond City. So there was about eight of them. So that's it. So I suggest the ministers record that you noted them and they had been previously electronically approved, and we can, in the minutes, we'll list them all properly so that there's a record.
So do we need a motion for that, do you think?
Probably, I think so, yes.
So would somebody like to make a motion that we confirm, I guess, the approval of the proposals that we handled electronically during the last quarter?
I'll make that motion.
And is there a second?
No, second.
Thank you. All those in favor? Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Anybody opposed? No. Thank you.
So the other thing, there was mention of the Open Meetings Act, actually at the last meeting, but since then, and there was mention of closed meeting criteria, since then one of the DNR agencies, who the agency was involved in some controversial decisions that their board would have to make, and the director, won't name which agency, it doesn't matter, but the director finally is worried about the controversy, public order, read through the Open Meetings Act and sort of suddenly took a tape back thinking, how, we don't do half these things. And at the same time, a local paper, not Salt Lake, but the local paper tracking the same issue realized they started looking for minutes and tapes and pointed out politely, hey, there seems to be stuff missing that should be on meeting sites. And that's then sort of worked its way to Mike Styler's level, executive director level. And we quickly realized all of us hadn't really looked at the detail and intent of the meetings, Open Meetings Act. And we all needed to smarten up what we do. There was a table in your notes that listed some of the key things. But I can summarize them. We're all the divisions are going to get training next week, actually. They're going to get everyone. And in fact, chairs are invited. But my feeling is chair, or whoever else is going to be chair, just says, look, I'm relying on the board secretary and the director to keep us following state code. You're welcome to come, but I don't think it's probably a high-level thing. It really rests ultimately on my shoulders and Pam's as board secretary. Make sure we adhere to the requirements.
Yeah, I looked at it. I looked at the regulations after the last time, before the last meeting when we discussed it, when you discussed it. And I thought we discussed the things then that we probably needed to fix, but maybe we'll find out otherwise.
So within 3 days of this meeting, Pam's got two things she has to do.
Yeah.
The tape recording has to be on the public meetings website. There's a state meetings website, so that tape has to be uploaded. So we had to figure we've never downloaded stuff. In fact, it turned out we were keeping it for until the next meeting and then over recording. So we actually didn't even have sort of tape sitting somewhere, just the modern digital technology. So that's the, and then the unapproved minutes. So the minutes have to be assembled for what we've just, for this meeting. Within 3 days, and unapproved minutes have to also go on that side, and they'll probably go on our website as well. The unapproved minutes, we've got 30 days. The approved minutes that we've just done have about 3 days to get on the site. So there are a whole lot of things there that all the divisions actually were pretty sloppy on, and we thought the minutes typically were on websites, but we didn't need to be more than that.
When is the training?
The training is, an email just came around, it's 2 o'clock on the 16th, I think, Tuesday, let me just check. 2 till 3:30 down in the auditorium, correct, Open Meetings Act, DNR Auditorium. So yeah, very welcome, but if it's inconvenient, I wouldn't sort of have heart, but it could be useful if you sit in on other meetings to being chair too, actually, just hear what the official interpretation is. So we've got obligations there, and clearly with closed meetings, the criteria are pretty well defined, and I'm sure they'll cover them again. But typically it's if personnel matters have to be addressed, then that's justification for declaring a closed meeting. Potentially, if there's financial business type stuff, which for us is not normally the case, if it's just strategic, that should be public. But where I was thinking, where there could be something, if we're involved in a big proposal, say as a subcontractor, say to the university, and it's big, that the board should be aware of it because we're committing UGS to something, and it's competitive, and that prime contractor says, look, how we're putting the proposal together is confidential.
Yeah.
That would be where the board should know, but we go into closed session just because of the financial sensitivity. So
would
that would be
Would Forge be an example of something that could potentially be that way? Because it's a competitive situation.
Not now. There's Carbon Safe is our other big one. I think they're past it, but maybe at the time proposal being put together, that's where something could come up. And the bottom line there, I remember Tom Tripp saying, because he was on the Grantsville City Council, that they have to record on a separate tape recording, a separate file, the closed meeting session. And that has to, that gets kept confidential. And I don't think subject to grammar, but at some point, someone could access it. So you've got to be careful. And the other thing came up at the leadership meeting this week, because of grammar requests, and there's a couple floating around, one of them affects us. Everyone has to be super careful on emails, because they're and typically accessible by grammar. So sort of if you know the person well and start in on personal stuff, that's all going to come out if it's part of that email that's is being collected. So be really careful. And if in doubt, and you know there's sensitive stuff that you want to talk about, it's best to buy phone. Bottom line. But even then, you could be called, subpoenaed or something, and so you got to be, everyone's just got to be really careful. Any questions on that, on with respect to board behaviour or what's required or anything from us? I guess you're relying on us to know what's going on. Okay, so in terms of the financial material, in fact, the packet had a whole lot of stuff. That's unusual because it's just the time of year. We produce a mineral lease report for county's legislature because we're a recipient of mineral lease, and Jogi was the one that compiled that. Over the years, we've shortened it because I'm not sure anyone actually reads it, but it's there. We're obliged to do it, and I'm sure there are mineral lease recipients that don't produce annual reports, but it's such an important source of revenue for us. We've always kept that up, and we always send a copy to the Association of Counties. They're the main recipients with their service districts of mineral lease data, and if anyone starts playing with the formula, either federal level or state level, we're usually relying on the counties. We're such a small player, 2.25%. We're pretty vulnerable, so it's important to keep counties in the loop, that they realise we're doing valuable stuff, valuable work with that source of revenue. So, and then there were performance measures in there, which again we do just in front of the legislature in a session. We don't have to do that. There have been various governors have come in and changed things, and they all sort of want some sort of feedback. They actually stem from Levitt's time. We've always kept it up, knowing things change, and then they're asking for metrics, and there's about 20 different metrics we track with multiple ones in each program. Yvonne, the legislative analyst, often, just leading up, says, hey, I need a metric to put in the what they call the COBE compendium of budget information that goes out to legislators. So we've just kept it up every year. Even though we're not formally required, it seems about every second or third year we're digging into it and saying, we've got that metric.
So I will say that that may be part of the reason that when things kind of went south on us in 2014, 2015, my observation was that compared to the other agencies that we were kind of struggling to get more funding from the state with, I think we were better organized.
Yeah.
That's probably because we had it. I'm guessing that's because you have all this
partly. And every year, of course, we get 15, 20 minutes in the sunshine trying to convince them we're valuable and doing useful stuff for the state. And that adds up over the years. I've always found it's actually pretty tough, no matter how well you're prepared. The technology may not work. You know, you may go in there with 5 slides that really hit it, and you discover you can't talk to the screen, and you've got to go with handouts. And then you discover legislators are busy. They're worrying about their bill, and they're on phones and on their laptop and walking out. And I had 1 year, even though it's going to take 1 year, there were only 2 left, a chair and 1 other. And I'm trying to convince them how good what we do. So it's pretty soul destroying. That's it for the year, unless some crisis happens and you've got to go to interim and go.
Except they responded positively.
They did, yeah. So, particularly all the senators, they appreciated what we did. That was great.
And so, this year, you're not expecting that sort of.
No, we're not. And I was going to mention down here in terms of legislative issues, but I'll jump there now. We do actually have an item that developed yesterday. Sort of a good news item. Put it in here. Pull that out. We highly likely will have a state dinosaur.
Yeah, we've been watching that in the paper.
So it came out, there was a listed bill number we saw on Monday, SB 43, Kurt Bramble. So it had gone from the newspaper to actually a bill. So I emailed him. I talked to Jim first.
He's been in the paper too.
Yeah, I know. And he was recommending don't get rid of Allosaurus because the Cleveland Wells site is famous for the collection of Allosaurus there. And skeletons from there have gone all around the world, including as the main feature up at the Museum of Natural History. But have a state dinosaur. So I asked Jim, we'll put together a list of all the states where they have state dinosaurs, state fossils. So we spent an hour going through the website doing it, and there are about 10 states that have a state dinosaur, and several that have a state dinosaur and a state fossil. So I sent that and a couple of figures that Jim had put together, the thing that's circulating is it, to Senator Bramble and said, hey, if we can help, Jim's suggestion is to do the dinosaur in addition rather than getting rid of Allosaurus, but let us know if we can help, or committee time. Jim can go and support it. He immediately emailed back and said, I've already seen the newspaper discussion. He already had the bill written. It's effectively an addition of 6 words. The state dinosaur of Utah. The Utah state dinosaur will be the Utah raptor. That's the extent of the bill.
Well, if they need any publicity or anything, Gary Prathen did a bronze of the Utah raptor down on First North, and it's really beautiful, isn't it? It actually, as you drive by, kind of appears it's going to leap on the hood of your car.
So First North and?
Right out in front of the museum, which is about Second East, I think.
Oh, up at the...
Right in front of, yeah.
Which museum are you talking about?
CEU, Prehistoric.
Oh, yeah, down in Price. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, and really apparently, is it Rob Gaston who does, this is his, there's a new skeleton being prepared, which is this one, from the most recent past. It's at BYU had found the skull of something, and they put together something based on all the latest pieces, and I'm not sure where that's ending up. But yeah, it's the sort of good news thing that Jim commented as he was going through the various states, that when he looked at the history of how they got to be state dinosaur or state fossil, in most cases it was a school initiative, some school kid or a class said, hey, why don't we have this? And of course politicians think, yeah, why not? You know, a feel-good thing. So he's embraced that, and he's already got the second version, which keeps the Allosaurus, and this is recommended as state dinosaur. So it keeps everyone happy.
Great.
So we'll see. Jim whether he has some tries to have some publicity. It's highly likely to go through.
I think there was an article in there about it.
Yes.
There was. Yeah. Fairly extensive article.
Yeah, it was.
So that's about the in terms of the legislature. I think anything we're aware of and that's anything related directly to us. So in terms of our financial position, you probably saw some of the numbers. Maybe we'll put up that front review summary page in our bottom line position to show you. Probably the most important chart. Can you expand it slightly? Is there a way? Just that bar at the bottom. Yeah. Oops, there we go. Yeah, so the changes, actually from the August numbers you saw, they're fairly similar, although in detail there are changes there. Revenue, the Forge project had been cut and there's now 175,000 extra, got resumed, so there was a plus 175 there. Jody, the federal, the loss of 200K, 220 federal, was that some project that fell over or?
Yeah, I can explain. Try not to focus too much on the year-to-date revisions because we have to start the year with the appropriated budget, and that is based off of last year's budget request. So that's almost a whole year plus removed from our true operating budget. So then once we actually get to July, August, we have our operating budget for the year, and we have a better idea of what grants have come through, which ones haven't, and then we revise what we got appropriated. So a lot of those year-end or year-to-date revisions are just general revisions to get us from what was appropriated to what we now know is a good operating budget for that about a year lap from when the request went in to what we know at that time. So that's what a lot of that is. But throughout the year, once we set that, throughout the year, I do make changes for if we get awarded a new grant or if we are falling behind on a different grant or we don't get one that we initially estimated getting. So those are some of the adjustments that we'll have after August. But before that, those year-to-date revisions are mostly just to get our operating budget in line with or adjusted from what was appropriated. The main big changes that we had from our original estimated appropriating budget that we did, or operating budget that we did last meeting, was we increased the dedicated credits by about 200,000. The majority of that was 175,000 of new Forge money that came in. And then the other major adjustment was we reduced our mineral lease estimate by about 127,000. That is actually on this current month. You can see up here this current month revision. That was the adjustment I made in November because Mike Vandenberg had updated his estimates. And so we are now estimating about $1 million less there. So that's... That's the main changes.
And the indicators at the moment for mineral lease, we may actually go back and maybe climbing. They're not negative at the moment, but things are always unstable. Natural gas price, the prices in the east they're paying at the moment are phenomenal. I don't know whether you've looked, Mark, and up over $100
too. Oil's 162.
And 62, yeah, so...
I mean 62.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, 162.
Well, that'd be expensive.
Got to 148.
Yeah. So, who knows, at the moment, with $60 a barrel prices, the industry's actually fairly positive again. It's getting into the area that they can drill these deeper wells and get decent production.
There are a lot of moving components that's to the mineral lease equation, and it's not just price and volume produced for us. It's also whether that production is coming from federal land, which generates mineral lease money, or from tribal land or private land, which doesn't. And because of the nature of the plays in the Uinta Basin right now, an increasing amount of drilling is going on the Indian tribes' land, and so we don't get any mineral lease component from that. State still gets severance tax from that, but mineral lease money isn't generated by that.
Right.
And so even production has gone, you know, peaked in November of 2014 at about 94,000 barrels a day. Then the trough was in July of 2016 at 60,000 barrels a day. And as of August, it's back up to 77,000 barrels a day. And probably by now, it's 80 or so. The Dogham normally reports their production numbers 4 to 5 months in arrears. It takes a month before they have to be reported by the operators, and then it takes them a while to get it all handled. This year they've been running 6-7 months behind, and found out that the reason is that they have chosen not to report until they have 99% of the operator reports in hand, so that they don't have to go back and make a significant adjustment to the number later. And I understand that, but they had 3 months that were like 98.45 or something like that, you know. And so they gave us those because I'm doing some other projects that involve mineral lease revenue. And we were just, we had a gap for almost the whole year. And so, but prices are up significantly, at least for the moment. Some of it's politically motivated, so I'm not sure how long it's going to last. But right now, both volumes and prices are up, and so even though the focus has shifted a little bit away from federal land, there will be more on federal land. There's more coming, for sure. I mean, there are plans out there that are public that will involve work on federal land, so hopefully we'll get healed up a little bit by that.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the notes, we were surprised with the August number. You can see the down down in the bottom right there, the mineral lease trend. Sort of after the July number, we got Mike Vandenberg tracks these numbers, and it's got a pretty good model for it. But boom, straight into August, and we were way below what we thought we should be. The number was small. You can see, Jody's highlighted it up there. Which had us sweating, and then we thought, it's just a reporting time, and it'll come in next month. But it hasn't. So there was a wrinkle there where there was a freak combination of low prices, low volume that caused August to be down. August.
It was August. Yeah.
And then the reason, of course, October's high is this stupid sequestration that the feds do. You get back what they sequestered the previous year, gets added into August up there, so it's 200. That's at 215. It's up. You can see it up there in October. So we'll see. I think we'll go close to that number that we've got in the budget, I think, and with a bit of luck, it might be a slowly uptrend.
I will say that this other project that I'm involved in has resulted in meetings with the three largest producers in the Uinta Basin who produce 80% of the oil in the Uinta Basin. And they all have aggressive plans to expand production, perhaps by 100%. And one of the limiting constraints is that right now, the refineries are maxed out, and the refineries have a seasonal variation in how much black waxy crude they can take in, and it goes down this time of year, but there's also some turnarounds going on, so repair work being done at the refineries, and so there's actually oil being shipped out of state again for the first time since 2014, probably, or 2015, early maybe, and so that's another thing that's come to light, is that the refinery capacity in Salt Lake is between 70 and 90,000 barrels of this oil a day. And so right now at 77,000 barrels a day or so, we're sending 3,000 barrels a day out of state. So the hopeful side of that is that production overall is going to continue to increase because people that I was concerned might look elsewhere to spend their budgets are seriously contemplating major expenses in Utah. So that'll be good for us.
So looking at the notes here, yeah, the chances are we're going to end up, I don't know, 500,000. So in other words, we're sort of close to where we had the carry forward from the previous year. Our long-term goal, as we've discussed in previous meetings, try to get up towards a million there, just because having suffered the layoffs and numerous retirements of the 2 years ago with the downturn, we don't want to have to repeat that. So that's the angle we've been working with the legislature, in particular John Bob, the legislative analyst, to get the appropriate intent language this session in the committee approved, which allows us to accumulate effectively unspent mineral lease, or if it comes in higher right at the end. The argument's always been we learn about it so close to the end of the year that effectively we can't suddenly spend it, and it's not in the state's interest for us to go on a spending binge just to clean out the revenue that we realise in June is suddenly coming in. The responsible thing is to be able to carry it forward, and it goes to cushion future changes in the year. They've bought into that. The governor's office, a meeting months ago now, it was June, July, we had with the governor's analyst, the legislative analyst, and DNR executive saying, look, that's the biggest issue we've got. We need tidied up. So I think it's in the intent language is in this year, this coming session's recommendations from the legislative analyst. And that'll make it much easier then as we get to the end of the year to, if it's suddenly it's up 300,000, we can put it towards.
So the recommendation will be that the survey be allowed to accumulate $1 million rainy day fund or something to that effect?
It got modified. You can do it, Jody.
We initially wanted to do the million, mm-hmm. and then you have to do it on a yearly basis, and you have to justify what you're going to spend that on,
okay.
and that you're actually going to collect that. They have what they call budget prep. It's the application that we use to prepare the budget, and things have to balance within that. And to make a long story short, that million was a little bit of a stretch that we were actually going to get to that. In 1 year, and so we talking with Yvonne, we reduced it down to 750,000. But each year we're able to change that language and propose new language. So you know, if we close the year at 500,000, and then next year we think we might have another 400, then we'll bump that up.
Good. But anyway, they've accepted we're in a special case, and there's only a few other state agencies that have that situation. PIPCO are the same. I think they get some mineral lease from revenues. And they routinely set it aside. They're able to argue a strategic purpose as a legal fund for the governor's office and legislature. And so they've been doing it just because mineral lease goes up and down.
Help me out. What's PIPCO?
Public Lands Coordination Office. Kathleen Clark's.
Yeah.
A bunch of attorneys or whatever helping the governor and legislature strategically for the state. So hopefully we got that fixed. And of course, we're very sensitive with the legislature. They helped us out big time 2 years ago with that million when we would have had to lay off more people. It's absolutely vital we justify. They still remember that, and particularly the analysts say, oh, do you really need that? So we need to just show, it's absolutely crucial for our viability. There's people's salaries hinging on that.
So there's been essentially a fundamental shift in our funding.
There has.
Sources.
Yeah, we're up to 50% general fund, that $4 million.
And we were a third.
Never had a figure like that for general fund compared to the bottom line, so it's roughly 50%. That makes us really strong in terms of our other funding sources being so variable that sort of underpins, it recognizes the agency as core functions.
Especially with a lot of federal contracts being unknown at this stage, basically.
Flaky or whatever. and I'll come to that. It's outwardly, everyone's nervous, but the vibes we're getting, in fact, I'll lead into that. So particularly, our groundwater program, looking through over the years, is steadily growing, multiple sources of funding, groundwater is really important, and it's the lifeblood of the state. If you can't get the water you need, pretty important economically, and so how much is there, the hydrogeology becomes important. But they've also got a wetlands group that's grown from nothing that's EPA funded, federal funded, and the EPA is under a lot of spotlight. But back in, I think they said, the wetlands people I talked to them yesterday, in October, there was a review done from Region 8 EPA of our wetlands program. They were very happy, and they said at the time, with what we've done, not very happy with the situation, obviously, in DC, but they said at the time, there's two very discrete aspects to their budget. There's the budget in DC that supports personnel and thing, and then there's a separate budget which is state monies that go out to the states, and they can't switch money from one to the other, and obviously Congress watch really closely if it's money that's earmarked for environmental type work, like wetlands in different states, they're watching that doesn't get hit. So they actually said, they've told us for this coming year, there'll be another solicitation coming out for the wetlands type work. We've been doing a lot of work around Great Salt Lake. They used to have a target area of climate change, and that's off the books. They can't say that now. And it's just generic. And they've said, the sort of work you're doing, great. You're the main agency doing wetlands work, and every likelihood you'll get a similar budget for the coming year. So despite all the rhetoric that you read about budgets and what they're at, short of a total budget crisis in DC, which I guess is never impossible, but they're trying to avoid, the EPA, which I would have thought was the most vulnerable, is okay. But there are other areas, as I mentioned in there, in terms of fossil fuel research, that agency has been trim, because research developments and industry have been so successful with deviated drilling and fracturing technologies. And we've got oil and gas, the issue, we can find plenty at the moment. So why put a lot of money into more research at the moment? We're reaping the benefits. And well, that used to be where Tom, Chidsey, Craig were running big projects, Uinta Basin, Paradox Basin, yep. And strategically pulling together a portfolio of Utah's resources.
Major we had plays.
We had a lot of federal funding. It's been on for the last 15, 20 years, but that's drying up. And so we see in our budget this, the $1 million increment general fund actually is helping. So where is it going? Well, it's probably going to sustain our expertise in oil and gas resource assessment and other areas that got hit as the people retired and we had layoffs. But that's one important area that the UGS needs to continue to have, because there's ongoing questions. We've seen it the last few months with the battle over land management, Bears Ears, Escalante, and of course immediately the questions get asked, well, what resources are here? You know, is that a factor? Bears Ears is probably the best example. We've been asked on various sources. Everyone wants to know, from the governor, the legislature, the private entities, the public. We've got to have people that have got their hands on that information. So we have to sustain that area. It's not going to disappear. The sort of questions we get are going to be variations on the theme, but we're going to get that over and over. And we need to be the Johnny on the spot with that info. So I mentioned Craig Morgan's decided he's retiring to St. George, got his house already, and shifted up. He was originally going to be made. He spent Christmas down there and said, hey, this weather's fantastic. I'm not sure.
But he wasn't here.
But also, summers are a little different, but at this stage it's fantastic. So he said, I'm pushing my retirement forward. Yeah. It's the middle of March, I'm out of here. So we are obviously thinking now, we need to look at his replacement. He's pretty crucial. Both him and Tom came on board about 20 years ago, had 10 years in the industry working not only in Utah but in the Intermountain West, and were able to hit the track running and ended up securing all these federal projects and things like that. That's who we need again. is, I think, we probably have to advertise at senior geologist level, but someone who's maybe in the second half of their career, maybe doesn't want the corporate uncertainty, doesn't like Houston, thinks, hey, Utah's pretty good.
There's a lot
or
of those.
Whatever.
Yeah.
There are, I know. But we'll have to be realistic. We can't just advertise a starting level. I think that's down the track. If their group was to grow or anything, then they might need help at a different
level. Is it worth trying to do some targeted recruiting? For example, talking to the U and BYU and seeing who they are in touch with. I mean, there are guys that graduated from BYU that I know of 10 years ago have been working for Exxon and things like that.
Might
come back here in a heartbeat, you know.
Mike Vandenberg is the new program manager.
Right.
Because of his work in the Uinta Basin with Lauren Bergenheuer, and they have corporate entities, they've had meetings in Denver. He's been on there. He's known what was coming up this year. And he already knows a few people. I'm not sure where they're based, and it obviously has to be an open employment process, but they're out there.
Yeah.
And he's got good, certainly for the Uinta Basin, the Lana Company. He goes to the one that's called Arabian Vernal, what do they call it, the cooperative?
The collaborative.
Collaborative, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quarterly meeting.
And there's mechanisms there to get the word out, and at senior geologist level, even though it's not a fantastic, it's probably a pathetic salary by industry standards, there still could be excellent people that are interested. So, that's...
Craig's retiring comfortably to St. George. I mean...
that's right. So
will that be a hard retirement, do you think, or will he be interested in doing stuff on the side?
No, I think I've sort of chatted. I'm pretty sure that's a time for a new life change or whatever. I don't think he'll be hanging his shingle out. Craig Morgan Enterprises. do have an informal geologic society down there, the Dixie, what they call it, Dixie Geological Society, which has been active in some years and inactive. But we've heard a number of people have gone down there from different geology people. So there's quite a cluster down there.
One other, back to the EPA funding issues. It sounds to me like... we're somewhat relying on the vigilance of our congressional delegation to make sure that our stuff is taken care of. Do they know that we're doing that? In other words, are we in communication with them, or is that not our job?
No, occasionally. So state surveys typically have two initiatives a year, interim fall and spring meeting, where groups of them go around, knock on doors, and if there's initiatives, they're typically pushing other initiatives. But, and for a few years, I did that, and then thought, my effort's better spent here locally. They also have staffers here, and once a month, Utah's almost unique in this, they have what's called the NRCC, Natural Resources Coordinating Council. So land management agencies, federal and state, get together for a breakfast meeting. In fact, it's next Tuesday, it's the next one, 7:30 to 9 o'clock, round table, what issues are there, staffers are there, congressional staffers, and then we have the once a year field trip where you're actually sitting with them and chatting, and that's actually a more effective mechanism, working through their Salt Lake representative, and sort of going to DC and the big rush of roaring into these different buildings and hoping you click with the right staffer. I've concluded it's more effective doing the footwork here. But if it was really important, we do. So with the Forge Project, for instance, the university, who actually have lobbyists, and Joe Moore, who's the scientist, sort of the leading PI, they have been there just before Christmas. They did a round to the DC and were into the senator's office, Senator Hatch's office, talking to staffers. Mia Love was there, depending who was there. It was a bad week. It was the week that Bear's Ears were announced here. And he plans this big trip to go there and discovers they're all here. He's sitting in D.C. not visiting on doors. So,
well, again, the staffers are who matter and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So typically, you get to a staffer. It has to be an awfully important issue to actually get in front of the congressman.
Thank you.
What else did I have here? I'm trying to look for the page 2. slid across here. Though. So we don't have the personal year. Greg Buchelman retired. It's officially the 16th. There's sort of two sort of dates the state has. The last day you can show up and the settlement of salary and all that sort of stuff. So the 16th is officially his last day, although he's gone already. So Steve's here and can talk. If you want to briefly summarize how we're restructuring, filling in his position.
Greg was one of our landslide geologists, so we've transferred those duties to Greg McDonald and Rich Durow, and they're kind of divvying up that work. And then we're replacing the Schedule B full-time landslide geologist position with a 0.7 FTE TL, or time-limited position, that'll be geotech. We're looking for a student that's partway through their degree program where they can work part-time during the school year and full-time during the summer to help us mainly with a lot of data issues on geologic hazard mapping.
And the other, paleoseismology.
Oh, that one, yes. Chris DeRoz had taken a position with the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden several years ago. We didn't have funds to replace that. And so Emily Clever, who is a geologist that's been working on some hazard mapping, is going to team up with Greg McDonald and Adam Hiscock as kind of our new paleoseismology team.
Yeah,
and cover that.
Been a gap.
So we've got a dedicated person for paleoseismology.
Yeah. So there will be some a little bit of savings with, in effect, the bottom line geotech, which we need the help. And we'll just see how things go financially, sort of keep that up our sleeve as we get into the next FY as to where the effort's needed across the survey. We talked about Craig Morgan, so they're the two that we know about at this stage. And the other general point is sort of in succession planning and things like that. I haven't looked for a few months, so I'm trying to recall this, but I think we've got about 10 or 12 people out of the staff of high 60s that are eligible, could retire, so they're either above 30 years experience, the state definition of when you can retire without having your pensions penalised, or are at least 65. So although we've had a big bubble for years, we've had this bubble of very senior people moving every year. They move up in age and worried about what's happening. And so we had a big correction with the downturn in funding and a bunch, I think it was 7 retirements in the space of 18 months. We normally get one a year. We're on the tailing edge of that baby boomer bubble, I guess, and there was hiring back in the 80s or whatever, and some of the people have, of course, joined subsequently. So there is going to be steady turnover the next 3 or 4 years. And I'm in that bundle as well, 66. So quite a few. So the program, you know, succession for each of the programs is important to make sure we sustain the expertise. That's going to come.
Is there a state retirement age requirement?
No, there's, and you can't discriminate on the basis of age, obviously. So you've got to be, it's even for the director or the boss can't just say, hey, when are you thinking of retiring?
Yeah,
you've got to be really careful.
Well, I remember that from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you've got to be really careful.
Figure out how to ask it without asking it.
Yeah, the code is, what are your career objectives? Try to turn it positively and see whether it'll say, oh, a couple of years, I'm out of here. Or, none of your business, I'm going to stay forever.
Okay.
Some people do. But so, yeah, at 30 years service, it's typically the threshold the state has. But people work beyond it. So we've got several that are sitting at 35 years on staff. And you just hope you get enough notice that you can sort of plan what the strategy is, the succession strategy. What else did I have here? We're going to stop slightly early. There's a couple of action items because Hugh Hastie, he's got another meeting. Hugh Hurlow's going to be the first of the presentations. He wants to start at 10 on the dot and be out of here by 10:30. He's talking about the pinyon juniper stuff.
Okay.
So the break will have to be before that. 9:45 to 10, and then the other couple of meetings can follow that. So is there anything else in a general way you need from me? We've covered, I think, a lot of the stuff that was here. There was a lot of support material.
Do we need to talk about the...
Yes, there's the two action items we can handle and then take a break is what I would suggest. Right. So maybe I'll talk generally about them, what looks to be a good idea. Now, I have that on the third page, somewhere or other. Yeah, right. So the two things there, dates of the board meetings, which it's worth trying to approve them, identify the issues now, just so that we can all lock them into the calendar and... If suddenly something, some event comes up later, we have to shift it. We do it, but we try to avoid it just for everyone's planning purposes. So the dates we've suggested there and why we choose them, we're supposed to officially have 4 meetings a year. That's the other thing with everyone looking at code and saying, well, you know, what should we do? The way we've always done it in the past is informally called the field trip, a meeting. Because we're looking, I'll talk about it in a minute, it's going down to Cedar City, having the 2 nights there and doing stuff there in the field meeting. I suggest with the new building, it's a good opportunity where we have we'll just have a 1-hour meeting, which we can call the meeting, can talk about what the plans are. Tyler's going to be our host on the Saturday. Whether it's the end of the day Friday as we drive down, or we start at 8 o'clock in that building. It's on a Saturday, but for the sake of 1 hour, we can talk about what we're going to do. We'll figure that out as we get closer to the meeting. So they're the dates. Are there any obvious clashes or dates that seem to be inappropriate? The one thing I thought of this morning as I'm looking at things, we've repeated the second week of January. When do we get the 6-month numbers? Or is that not till February? When does December closing?
So, for example, it closed last Friday. So this week I'm doing billings and reports. So I'll have numbers, you know, mid-January.
So maybe there's an advantage there. Third week of January, the legislative session, we've always sort of tried to have it in front of it just in case there's a big issue coming up and somehow the board or representative of the board has to be involved. But there's some merit in shifting it a week later from what I've shown there so we can get the 6-month position. It's kind of nice to have a 6-month financial position, which would be... say a mid-Wednesday, 7 days after that. So that's going to be 7, 9, or 16. 16th would be Wednesday. May or may not be the start of the session, but it'd be so early in the session. And if an issue comes up, it's really easy to email stuff around.
Sure.
Or if it's really important, they're going to close the UGS, you can call a special meeting. So that would be my... Does that suit you, Jody, to say the 16th?
Well, I'm just looking at... So we're talking January 2019, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, Finet will close on the first Friday of the month, will be the 4th. So I'll be able to do reports and billings that second week, the week of the 7th. So we could do it the week of the 14th. And that should be the week before the session still.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would say it's the middle of that week. So January 16, we're working backwards now. What about the other dates? Do they look okay? I know Sam has meetings.
On the Thursday is my actual board meeting.
Thursday, the third.
Third Thursday.
So May 10th before that. May 10th's okay, Thursday.
Yeah, that's just fine. What might miss that January meeting if it goes to the third week?
What about if it's Wednesday? Or we can make it the Tuesday.
If you make it a Tuesday, then I would be able to do it.
Well, at this stage, why don't we do that then? So that would be the 15th.
Is that okay? Yeah. Yeah.
And the field trip time, mid-September, there's a lot goes on in September. We always struggle with that one, in meetings and goodness knows why. So that's right in the middle of the month. It's, as far as everyone knows, is that okay? Friday, Saturday, Sunday, return. Yeah. So I don't think you need to vote on them. It's
no.
Just that we record in the minutes that's the decision for the future meetings. On the field trip, and again, we're sort of thinking about what stuff are we doing at the moment that's active. And it's really exciting what Bob Beek and a few of his colleagues have been working with, the realization of these mega slides or gravity slides. The scale of them so large, sort of 50, 80 miles, you end up shaking your heads thinking, have they got this right? But there's certainly one stop short of Panguitch, which is it's in the backcountry, but we can drive into it, where the pseudotacholite is, you can see the veins of Melbourne rock. And everything else is not metamorphosed or anything. It's got so hot that by the base of the slide that it's melted rock. It's fascinating. As it gets known, I'm scared, it's sort of like the little creed that geologists think it's so unique.
Take it out.
Yeah, you end up going back and see all these holes there and it's knocked off. And there's another place apparently where next to the Panguitch Dam where you can actually see the base of the slide. And they think it came all the way from the Tushuts, the Merriman, 20 million years ago. So this is a 20 million year event. The scale's so large, they've had a GSA Thompson field trip. It was mentioned in the survey notes. Top slide people in the country were looking at it and starting to recognize maybe it's not that unique, that just the scale's been so large that people mapping geology just never realize these terrains.
It's awesome. Bob Beek took us on the board on a tour of it several years ago. I don't remember, 5 years ago.
Did we go to that stop?
We didn't go to that stop, but we went and looked at the marker gun before it was expanded again.
Yeah.
And I mean, we think as geologists of processes that take a lot of time, usually. This is like, boom. Yeah. I mean, we're talking, I don't know, 100 miles an hour? Is that what?
Yeah, speeds. I'm talking even faster than that, which you need to get the heat to melt.
Yeah.
So that one's
so really cool.
That would be on the drive down. The suggestion was, if we're going down 89, stop somewhere for maybe another stop that Bob could leave, where the Arapian, the Salina area is kind of interesting, the big valley there. And so that would be the trip down, capture those areas, and then spend the Saturday with Tyler. And there's a ton of stuff there, landslides and all kinds of hazard events. He's been doing a lot of detailed mapping as well in that area. So we'd focus on that area. And then on the return trip on the Sunday, go via the Forge site. So you can get a feel for the scale of things there. So that's the gist of the trip. The details, we don't need to sort out, probably till the August meeting to present them, but if anyone's got ideas, would be good. That should be neat stuff. Cedar City's always amazing, that big green hollow slide that sits there, cabins up the top, a very large scale. They've got now a new subdivision built at the bottom. You look at
the cushion the fall.
The photo is looking up there, and you see all the hummocky terrain going right at the top, and you shake your heads thinking, God, maybe it's just good we're having dry winters at the moment. But it has moved up the top, set all the headscarp up there, sort of an active region. So whether we go there, and then, of course, there's the Coal Creek landslide that seems to move every 2 or 3 years. In fact, there was a small event a month ago that was in the news, too.
A couple of weeks ago, there was more movement there on SR-14 east of town.
Yeah, UDOT spent a fortune realigning that road, and they've got the road on, seems to get bigger and bigger as stuff comes down.
It's a constant event in that whole canyon. There's more landslides that go when you continue up 14. Yeah. There's a lot more of them.
So there'll be some interesting stops there around that area. So the dates you've confirmed, so we're probably good to go on that.
Right.
So what else?
Should we move on to the action item for the board chair? So the next item is that we need to elect the chairman and vice chairman of the board for the coming year. And Peter can't be here today because of some appointments that he and his wife had that couldn't be delayed. He is willing to continue as vice chair, and I'm willing to continue as chair. However, if somebody else is really interested in being the chair, I'm also willing to have that happen too. So Is there any discussion of that?
Well, I'll make the nomination that we retain the chair and vice chair for the coming year.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion of that?
Yeah.
This is actually not a tough job. The only time it requires any time that you don't really see here, just so that you know, is when, like, when we do get in a bind with the legislature, there might be an opportunity to go and speak and that sort of thing, which we've done. But and that doesn't actually need to be the chair either. That can be anybody that's got legislators that they've made contributions to. So all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, thank you. I'll let Peter know. So do you want to take a break now, or do you want to continue on down the road?
Hugh will be keen to get the earlier he can.
Okay. Why don't we tell Hugh he could start at 9:45 instead of 10?
Tell him. That's a good idea. Okay. So there's bagels and cream cheese. It looks like there's coffee there. And waters, obviously.